listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Jody Cantor has covered the Obamas since 2007, writing about their faith, friends, marriage, roots, and family, among other topics. She became the arts and leisure editor of the New York Times in 2002, the youngest person in memory to edit a section of the newspaper. She's currently the Washington correspondent for the Times. Jody is joined in conversation tonight with Adam Nagorny, the Los Angeles bureau chief for the New York Times since August 2010. Let's just say we've got insider access on the Aloud stage tonight, so you might be thinking of those questions. Adam served for 8 years before that as the paper's chief national political correspondent based in Washington, D.C. He's also the author with Dudley Clendenham of Out for Good, The History of the Modern Gay Political Movement. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Jody Cantor and Adam Nagorny. Please join me in welcoming them. Thank you.
Hey, everybody. Welcome. Thank you for coming. Thank you on behalf of both of us. I'm sure all of you have read this book, because there'll be a quiz after we're done. But if not, you should. I say as someone who did it. Jody, thank you for joining us. I guess long travel day today. Where are you coming from?
I was in Los Angeles for the entire day today, actually.
Okay. Sorry for the bad weather. I always make that joke to East Coasters, being a former East Coaster. Let me get right into it. Let's talk about the book a little bit. It's a fascinating portrayal of both Obamas, the relationship, President Obama, Michelle Obama. I was fascinated by you talking about the ideas of first couples being isolated, which I suppose is increasingly inevitable. I remember we saw that with Bill Clinton for sure, both Bushes, I guess Reagan. But the extent to which the Obamas might have been even worse about this, I don't know whether it's because of the circumstances of the time or because of them, but how they didn't do any socializing that other first couples had done. I saw this year they didn't even have a Super Bowl party for people. Is that because of him or her? Why are they like that?
It's funny because I think that they each play into it in a different way. But the main reason is the speed of the Obamas' rise. There's a great story in Kati Martin's book about first couples called Hidden Power, where she talks about George and Barbara Bush kind of accumulating friends across the South in the 70s. And Barbara Bush made an index card for every new person they met so they could kind of add them to their list. And soon they were sending out 10,000, 20,000 Christmas cards. The Obamas are like the opposite. Instead of rising in politics by making friends, they kind of rose in politics and then limited their friendship. The president became so instantly famous in 2004.
And after a speech, right?
Everybody did a speech at the Boston Convention, and everybody wanted to be friends with them and have time with them. And it's kind of like they put this cord around their friendships and said, no new friends, which they said again when they went to the White House. Sometimes I think it's the First Lady who's more limiting, and yet sometimes I think it's the president. You know, sometimes the First Lady, even though she's very wary of politics, is also sort of the better schmoozer of the two. So sometimes I think it's him, and sometimes I think it's her.
Yeah, there was a quote, I guess, was it one of their friends in the book where they said right after they took the White House, no new friends, that we're done with making friends?
Absolutely.
Interesting. Okay. How damaging do you think that is to them, the sort of insularity of them in terms of Washington social life and hanging out with other members of Congress or anyone except for the Chicago crowd?
I think it's damaging in two ways. One is, you know, these tiny gestures of goodwill that do mean a lot in Washington. They were newcomers to the town, especially, and didn't know that many people. Now, the Obama people argue, you know, with some reason that, look, the Republican strategy of total opposition was something that no canape or cocktail was going to break.
Maybe a cocktail.
Right, yeah, maybe a lot of cocktails. Right. But the the other way I think it hurt them is that presidents, you know, have ways of getting informal feedback, right, from lots of people, of kind of circumventing the very tight circle of information control in the White House. And Obama, you know, just not that long ago was sort of a free person in the world, gathering information in so many different ways, used his BlackBerry, as we know, during the campaign to informally get feedback from probably thousands of people. That ends in the White House. You know, he gets the fake BlackBerry. He's only allowed to email 10 or 15 people. So the fact that he's kind of not socializing at night means that he's missing out on some of that impressionistic experience that's so valuable for a president.
Was he like that as a senator, too? Did they avoid the whole sort of Georgetown, Washington?
Oh, absolutely. Right, they showed marked distaste for Washington. You know, there are stories of him going to the, you know, Congressional Black Caucus gala and being really turned off by the whole thing, in part because Obama was such a kind of serious person. He was the person who told me this story, of all people, was Jeremiah Wright in 2007. He told me a story about Obama going to Washington and going to the Congressional Black Caucus weekend and thinking it was going to be like a serious discussion of ideas all weekend. And instead, it was kind of one big party. And Obama was really, that was not his scene at all. And there was also this constant issue of absence in the family. And so not only was he trying to get back to Chicago as often as possible, but on the rare times when Michelle Obama would come visit him when he was in the Senate, he would often skip events and hang out with her instead.
Interesting. So did they not, for example, when they came here, sort of instituted friendships with old sort of couples in Washington or the old liners who might help them know the ropes, or...
You know, there are a couple of mentors, right? Like Tom Daschle is a real mentor.
I saw that, right.
To the president. But it's not a social relationship. And even what people say, a very interesting thing about having lunch with the president. He's got this little dining room off the Oval Office. And they say that the president does something that almost never happens at a political lunch. He skips the gossip.
Which,
as you and I know in our jobs, when you sit down with, you know, an elected official or a consultant or whatever, before you really get down to the business, there's always like a little casual, friendly trading of information and impressions. And the president doesn't do it. You sit down with him and he has an agenda and he goes right to it.
Is that reflecting the way Washington is now? Is that possible?
Well, certainly I think that it is somewhat reflective because, like, when Daschle was in charge in the Senate, he would go over to the White House with his wife, and they would have dinner with George and Laura Bush. And kind of behind closed doors, they did have that respectful, pretty congenial relationship. And, you know, the Obamas have socialized with Republicans a little more, but, you know, are the Obamas really going to have the Boehners over for dinner? We got a laugh out of that from you guys. It's just...
would you?
it's extremely improbable, right?
But I know
you can't even imagine those four people sitting down at a table together.
But I noticed in the book you said that they didn't have the Clintons over for dinner. Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton. That was like that. You would think they would have over for dinner.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, and I mean, the president and the secretary of state have what people say is kind of this respectful relationship between grown-ups, right? It's sort of two people on their best behavior. But the president and Bill Clinton have never really resolved their long-standing differences in anything more than a superficial way.
What does Michelle Obama think about both the Clintons? Do you have any sense of that?
Well, the last I heard was that Michelle Obama and Hillary Clinton...
This is gossip. This is what Boehner
and
this is what they should be talking about.
The last I heard was that Michelle Obama and Hillary Clinton and Chelsea Clinton were trying to look for a lunch date, which is interesting because I probably heard that like in November, say. So the fact that it had taken them all this time to try to do that, especially when you see in the book that Michelle Obama is constantly wrestling with Hillary Clinton's legacy as First Lady, right? She's afraid of being seen too much like Hillary Clinton, and yet she's also like her in certain ways, and especially when the issue of healthcare comes up, she's worried of facing the same charges as Hillary Clinton did. And so the fact that those three women were just sort of now looking for their lunch date was very telling.
Interesting. Tell us the story. One of the interesting stories that sort of gets at this in the book is the story of this, I don't know which year it was, but the Super Bowl in the White House. And in the screening room, the television screening room, and Obama, will you tell, sitting in the front row?
So this is right after inauguration in 2009, and the Super Bowl is coming up a couple days later, and aides are saying, well, you know, how should the president watch the Super Bowl? And it brings up an issue that I found again and again in my reporting, which is that in the White House, it's very hard to tell what is public and what is private, right? I mean, what is like a true kind of private event, like maybe just a friend or two comes over, it's not announced, it's not political in any way, versus what is, you know, something that belongs to the country, is official, is part of the political process, whatever. So they decide to expand the Super Bowl party into this sort of political gathering. They invite Congress, members of Congress from the states of the teams that are playing. They invite some wounded warriors to the White House. And when the party starts, the president is certainly courteous. There are very few stories of him actually being rude to people, but he's kind of cursory about greeting people. He says hi, you know, shows them the food, you know, whatever, whatever. But the game starts and he sits down in his chair in the front row, and he watches the game. And what aides described was this guy who had this kind of principled but naive idea that he was going to remain a normal person in the presidency, and that he wasn't going to be, you know, he's got this objection to being, like, we've seen this a lot with both covering him, right? He doesn't want to be the fake, oily politician. And on the one hand, right, that's very admirable in certain ways, but on the other hand, it prevents him from sometimes doing the schmoozing that's really necessary.
Interesting. Okay. Do you think, I was asking this later, but I'll ask you now, do you think that Barack Obama likes being president and that Michelle Obama likes being first lady? Do you have a sense of, and I realize it's ridiculous to ask the question 3 years in, but so what?
Yeah, no. I mean, I mean, we can't read their minds, mm-hmm. but the impression I got from the reporting the book was a little bit different for each of them. The impression I got with the first lady is that she had a very hard landing when she first got there. You know, that she was a kind of stranger in a strange land, and she experienced very quickly all of the worst parts of White House life, the confinement, the scrutiny. And it was only when she found her footing a couple of months into it, she developed her own projects. She also accumulated a lot of internal leverage because she was so popular on the outside, and they really needed her to do things, which meant she could get things done the way she wanted to. Inside the White House, she learned to adjust her life a little bit. You kind of learn the escape routes, you know, and how to make that life more livable. So things got better for her. The impression I had of the president was of, you know, a lot of frustration punctuated by moments of satisfaction. And I don't think that the day-to-day life of the presidency is something they cherish. And I don't think they're crazy for that. I mean, the conventional wisdom in Washington is that if you're the president and first lady, you should never complain because you've got all these privileges and, you know, given what's going on out there, how could you ever sort of sniff at the lifestyle you have? You know, the confinement, the claustrophobia are really terrible, and it's getting worse. I mean, even when Bill Clinton was president, he could go jog in a park outside. Barack Obama can't do that. And that kind of thing makes a real difference, I think, in your just sort of day-to-day happiness level. Michelle Obama says she actually exercises twice a day right now, sometimes now, because she's trying to make up for all the steps that
the lack of walking.
She literally can't walk around that much.
And they don't go to Camp David much, right? There's no Camp David sort of.
They do some Camp David. The first lady likes it because right. She doesn't have to get all dressed and there are no photographers. The president says he finds it a little bit artificial because it, you know, it's cut off. It's in the middle of this military installation.
Right. It does seem a little bit kind of odd place. I remember Bill Clinton once called the White House the, he might have stolen this line, the most expensive jail cell in America. So,
right, and he could do all these things that the Obamas can't do.
He went. I remember him going running and stopping off at McDonald's and getting. I remember him doing other stuff too, but we won't get into that here. Okay. Okay, so I get this goes into something weird with you in the White House here. I get an email from someone in the White House yesterday who will not be named, and he says, "I hear you doing this thing with Jody. I have some questions I'd like to load on you to ask her." I said no. I mean, my feeling was like, I'm a professional journalist. I can read the book. I can come up with this on my own. I was actually a little bit put off by this, but explain to me, and I realized that this was just part of this big campaign by
especially
the White House.
Especially since you're my colleague.
It's crazy, you know? It's like, and then I'm assuming that other people might have said yes. But why, explain to me what the White House has done to try to discredit the book. why they're doing it, and most important, how much does it help book sales? It's like they don't realize it's a mitzvah. You know?
Well, here's the weirdest part of the whole story, which is the White House really cooperated mm-hmm. with this book, and they didn't cooperate in like a small way. They cooperated in a pretty thorough way. And, you know, the more sensitive the material got, the more and more I was checking things with them. Mm-hmm. So, like, by the time I was done reporting, you know, the part of the book where Robert Gibbs really loses his temper and blows up at the First Lady who's not present and, you know, uses the F word on her, I had talked to so many people in that meeting that, you know, the White House knew exactly what I had. And they were very complimentary before publication about how assiduously I was checking things. And so I was very surprised when they started to issue these really antagonistic statements when the book came out. Ben Smith from Politico last week actually reported they hadn't read the book when they started to issue some of the statements. And they did some other things that I really thought were bizarre. And it's not that I'm sort of naive about political life, but I've been writing sensitive stories about the Obamas for 5 years, and I had never seen anything like this. They you know, were calling cable TV producers and saying that I had lied about the number of White House Christmas parties I attended, which of course I had done nothing of the sort. They circulated lists of errors, supposed errors in my book, except that their lists were actually filled with errors. And so some other people kind of independently fact-checked them and found that they were wrong. And it eventually sort of came back to haunt them, I think, in two ways. One, because you know, a lot of journalists in Washington, even competitors of ours, stood up and said, this is ridiculous. This is a, well, you know, this seems like a, like Jody wrote a pretty, you know, sensitive, well-rounded book about them, and it just sort of doesn't make sense. And also, the other thing that I think was very strange about it is that it, you know, other people have pointed out that it made them look so reactive, right? I mean, the standard line with these political books is usually the president and first lady are too busy worrying about the country's problems, right? To kind of worry about these things. And so I was mystified. I think a lot of our colleagues were mystified by it. I don't really have any great answers.
Can you explain what their motivation was? Were they afraid of something?
I mean, I don't want to speak for them. I assume that, you know, I assume that one of the sensitive things is that the book does reveal some behind-the-scenes dysfunction.
In terms of the staff of the White House?
In terms of the staff and the president's relationship with Rahm Emanuel. And the fact that the First Lady was critical at certain points of what was going on in the White House. Now, was she more critical than a lot of Democrats on the outside? No, her critique, I think, was ultimately in line with what a lot of other people were saying. So I don't know if it was because of that. But I guess the thing to mention in context is that what a lot of civilians don't know is that this White House does have a pretty combative relationship with the press. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for example, Adam and I have colleagues who are really on the front lines of covering the news of the administration every day. And they do get yelled at a lot. And they do find that the administration sometimes tries to undercut their stories.
I guess what I wonder is, and I guess I can see that in the give and take of a reporter trying to cover the White House, and hopefully we're all doing honest stories and they're pushing us to make sure they're right, but why would a White House be involved in discrediting them? In other words, like, why would my tax dollars go to paying for a White House to discredit a book, as opposed to, say, the DNC or the Obama campaign? Or
you asked, not me.
Okay.
You know, I do think it's interesting.
Okay.
I mean, it's also interesting because it's fascinating. It's fascinating because also to me, it just doesn't match the book.
Right.
You know, it just doesn't, you know, this was like a carefully researched, fact-checked book that also really talks about a lot of positive attributes of the Obamas too, right? I mean, we have Michelle Obama as a really strong, protective figure, as somebody who is handling the challenge of being the first African-American First Lady well, mm-hmm. who is a great mother who's taking the role of First Lady, which can be so formless and shapeless, and really finding meaning in it. We have a president who, even during a tough period, is genuinely trying to do the best for the American people, who comes across, I think, as a very honest, earnest guy. So even though the book also discusses various frustrations and stumbles on their part, a lot of people have read the book coming away and thinking, this is not by any means an unflattering portrait.
Do you think that it is pushed by the Obamas themselves? In other words, are the White House aides acting at the instructions of either the president or...
Well, again, we're speculating a little bit, but one thing that people have said is that it does prove, it is kind of in line, right, mm-hmm. with some of the reporting of the book, which is that these people are very new to mm-hmm. public life. There's a famous memo that David Axelrod wrote to Barack Obama at the start of yeah. the presidential campaign. You know the one that I'm talking about. And it was warning Obama about what he was getting into. And the memo says something like, you can be kind of thin-skinned, and you're not used to being sort of covered in a tough way, let alone attacked, and that's something that is going to have to change.
I saw Michelle Obama complain that, in one of the morning shows that the book characterized her as an angry black woman. I'm not sure I would agree with that characterization. I did think it portrayed her as determined and frustrated and assertive and angry at times. Is there anything wrong with that? Is that not kind of the way lots of sort of first ladies have been, and isn't it natural for a spouse to want to look out for his or her partner in that kind of public?
Oh, I think she's totally in the line of first ladies who, there's this kind of public-private thing with first ladies where a lot of them have very gracious public images that mm-hmm. are not, fake, but behind the scenes really have these spines of steel. You could almost say that it's a job requirement, right? Mm-hmm. That no man gets elected president without a really watchful, canny spouse by his side. Barbara Bush, Hillary Clinton, Nancy Reagan yeah. all considered in some sense tougher, right, than their husbands right. by the White House staff.
Right. Is Michelle Obama, how does she compare to some of the other sort of tough first ladies in the past? Like, how does she compare with say, a Nancy Reagan or a Hillary Clinton?
Yeah, I think some of her behavior is mild, actually, by their standards, because one thing we see her avoiding again and again is any kind of direct conflict with the White House staff. Part of what was fascinating about reporting with this is that she did have difficult relationships with both Robert Gibbs and Rahm Emanuel, but there was a muffled quality to it. It was mm-hmm. always through staff. That's part of Valerie Jarrett's role. There were always these intermediaries and these messages passed from back and forth. And so I think, unlike prior first ladies, she never wanted to be the spouse who was kind of directly clashing with the West Wing staff, right. directly telling the chief of staff what he should do.
Why, talk about a little bit the relationship between Mrs. Obama and Rahm Emanuel. Why was it so tense? What were some of the kind of things they sort of clashed about?
I think there were two issues. The kind of smaller one is that, Emanuel had a rough time with Hillary Clinton in the White House, and he openly told people in the White House, I learned the hard way to avoid the First Lady. And so they really kept their distance from each other, and sometimes they did have these weird interactions that frustrated both of them. Like, at one point, Emanuel is trying to pass the House Energy Bill, mm-hmm. promises Michelle Obama's presence at an event to a congressman from Florida without asking Michelle Obama first. She finds out, she gets very frustrated that she's essentially being used as a kind of pawn, to get a vote. She does the event anyway, but she goes back and says through intermediaries that she is not going to agree yet to campaign, for midterms. She's going to kind of withhold her agreement, which in turn makes Emanuel really frustrated because, mm-hmm. From his position, he's looking at it and saying, the midterms are going to be really tough. We're going to have to go to war without the president's staff. So there was stuff like that I think caused a lot of chafing. But the bigger issue was that they were really philosophical foils in terms of what sort of presidency they thought it should be, especially in the first year or two. You know, the thing to remember about Michelle Obama is that, like many political spouses, she believes that her husband is a transformative figure. Mm-hmm. Her particular thing is that she doesn't want her husband to be a kind of everyday politician, doesn't like the horse trading, doesn't like the deal making. She really pushed him to take on ambitious but politically unpopular legislation like healthcare reform, okay. immigration reform.
Which Rahm, by the way, did not. Rahm
exactly.
wanted to go small on it at healthcare.
And, okay, right. And so okay. Rahm has the cautious approach, right?
Or the
and
pragmatic.
He's very yeah. mindful of the rules of the political world. So that's where I think they're philosophical foils.
Are there differences then between, I was going to ask you this later, how are the First Lady and the President different, both in terms of their ideologies and also their views of what politics is about? Because maybe that gets into what her difference is with Rahm.
I think the difference is that they have differing degrees of trust and belief in government. You know, from the beginning of the relationship, they always wanted the same thing, right? They always wanted systemic social change, more access, more opportunity, more fairness. But the ways they went about that really differed. You know, the president goes to Springfield, becomes a legislator, decides that essentially passing laws is the way he's going to try to pursue that idea. And that's what the First Lady doesn't trust. You know, she sees the flaws of the legislative process, the way good ideas can either disappear or be weighed down with, you know, all sorts of political baggage. Her work has to do much more with going straight to communities, with working with neighborhood institutions, with changing minds. So she's a skeptic. I mean, it's funny. Aides say that even their attitudes towards the Republican Congress were different, that the president initially, you know, even when Congress was still controlled by the Democrats, the president had bigger dreams of bipartisan cooperation, and the First Lady was always a little bit more skeptical.
Does she then not like the sort of nitty-gritty of politics in a way that Obama, the president, does like it?
I don't know that Obama likes it so much either.
Yeah.
But she absolutely does not like the nitty-gritty of politics. But the entire White House doesn't. When you hear them talk about like Washington, you know, whether it's Axelrod or the president or the First Lady or the president's best friends, they talk about it in a. They say things like, we need to ignore the Washington noise, or we need to get away from the Washington games. I thought it was very interesting that even early in the administration, the president looked at the budget process and said, this is all kabuki. This is all just sort of, this isn't a real budget. This is just kind of a game. And that was kind of a fateful remark because his presidency ended up being so challenged by budget battles. But, you know, I guess the thing that I find complicated about this is that their feelings are not unlike most Americans' feelings about mm-hmm. politics, right? I mean, they're not crazy to hate some of the things about politics that they do.
Right, right. And ideologically, then, going on, are they simpatico? Are there things they disagree about? Iraq, I don't mean to get in the weeds, but Iraq war, or what to spend money on, or deficit reduction versus social services?
I don't think that, you know, the First Lady never gets granular on this stuff, mm-hmm. right? I mean, people in the White House emphasize again and again that you're never going to have Michelle Obama bursting into a room in the West Wing saying, you know, public option or bust, you know, on healthcare,
right.
or this ratio of, you know, of deficit reduction, you know, et cetera, et cetera. The thing that they do say is that she's very wary of sort of conventional political advice, that she really pushes him to be true to himself. You know, I also think that we always have these fantasies that first ladies are more liberal than their husbands.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering about in this case. I mean, I think it was true with Barbara Bush, right?
Yeah, Laura Bush. Yeah, I mean,
maybe both, but okay.
There are intimations of that with the Obama story, especially with healthcare reform and immigration reform, which were the two instances I found. But it could also be the difference between, you know, kind of taking action, you know, the desire, right, to sort of put your neck on the line and take action on these issues in a bold way versus, you know, that more kind of Rahm Emanuel desire to be cautious and wait for the right moment.
So was that, do you think that's sort of a shibboleth? It just isn't true that first ladies tend to be more liberal than their husbands? Is that
I guess what we always see is that we always see liberals and progressives kind of assign this wish.
Right.
To the I don't know if any of you guys read this great Curtis Sittenfeld novel called American Wife, which was based on Laura Bush. And did anybody read that book? It's a great novel. So, but the book ends, it was written during the Bush administration, and the book ends with the Laura Bush character standing up to her husband and trying to get him to end the Iraq war. Well, Laura Bush was never going to do that, you know, in real life. It just was not going to, I mean, and also there's this pattern of first ladies really seeing up close everything that their husbands are confronted by, right?
Right. I guess with Laura Bush, the issue was abortion, right? Abortion rights.
Yeah.
And I guess what I would wonder with the Obamas is gay marriage, whether or not.
I wonder the same thing.
That's the one. That's what
except that we don't really, like, we don't really know where the president is on that, you know, in his true heart of hearts as well.
Right, right.
I mean, it's pretty clear that you know, he's dropped some pretty strong hints that he wants to see the country, right, sort of move in that direction and for it to happen on a more local level, and that he's willing to follow that lead.
Right. Right, that makes sense. I was a little bit sort of surprised in the remark I asked you about before, the racial component of her characterization of you. In other words, the angry black woman. Am I right in thinking that normally that's not something the way she, I don't know whether it's the way she thinks about stuff, but the way she frames stuff? Because I know with the president, he avoids that kind of stuff either because he doesn't want to get into it publicly or doesn't believe it, but was that a rare kind of thing for her? Do you think she thinks of the world as black and white in racial terms, do you think?
I think that there are hints that she very acutely feels both the possibilities and the pressures of being the first black first lady. I mean, first of all, she, you know, those attacks on her in 2008, the period where she was really attacked in a very unfair way, and, you know, things she said were ripped out of context, and, you know, Fox did the whole, like, you know, Barack baby mama thing, and that hit her very, very hard. I mean, friends and aides describe her, you know, as being just totally shocked during that period that people could say those things about her. And in the White House, I mean, she did tell aides, you know, for example, that one of the reasons she dresses so carefully is that everybody's waiting for the first black first lady to make a mistake.
Mm-hmm. It was to overdress or to wear $16,000 earrings.
Or, you know, not look fancy enough, right? I mean, there was one morning when very early in the administration where they first got Beau the dog, and she was walking the dog that morning, and she was dressed the way people dress to walk dogs. I mean, she was wearing like kind of a, you know, old ratty pair of shorts and a tank top, and her bra strap was peeking out a little bit, and her hair wasn't done, and she didn't have any makeup on. And the pictures were all over the internet in like 1 minute. And it's not that she looked terrible. She looked the way any of us would look at 6 a.m. walking a dog, right? I mean, she just looked like a normal mom, and yet seeing yourself magnified and multiplied that way, that's very hard.
Do you think she looks at that as a racial kind of thing, or is it just a sort of being in the public?
One of the reasons the Obamas ran for the presidency is that it was specifically to reverse stereotypes, and I think where it really comes out is the story in the book about the decision to do the Vogue cover.
Right.
She gets invited to do the cover of Vogue, and her group of advisors, all women, splits by race. And it's very uncomfortable because they're a close-knit group. And she and the other African-American advisors really want to say yes to the invitation because to them, there have been so few women of color on the cover of Vogue. You know, it's such a rare chance to reverse a negative stereotype, and she wants to take it. The white advisors are much more conscious of the economy, and they're saying...
So Gibbs and...
This was actually just an East Wing thing. So Gibbs wasn't even involved in this. This was Anita Dunn and a couple of other advisors saying, you know, wait a second, you are... you know, first of all, you're a person of substance. Do you really want to be known as America's kind of fashionista? But also, you know, Vogue is a pure luxury magazine. To buy it on the newsstand costs something like $5, you know, and they were very worried about the message that would send. Meanwhile, she did the cover and it was fine.
It was fine, right?
There have been a lot of other times when she's been accused of being, you know, too fancy, too loud. We talk about the line between the personal and the political. What Republicans were able to do was take their argument about how much Obama was spending on things like the stimulus mm-hmm. and apply it to the Obama's personal spending. Mm-hmm. You know, so they make a big deal about, you know, what Michelle Obama wears or the fact that they take Air Force One to New York for the evening or mm-hmm. whatever, and try to make that an argument about government spending.
I was struck your observation at the end of the book that the Obamas had sort of followed opposite trajectories, and he had started from the top of the world to the grueling reality of being president, and she went from severe apprehension about going to the White House to actually coming to like it a little bit. My question, this is more an historical book question. How difficult is it to draw conclusions in a book like this after just 3 years in the White House? Is there enough time, enough experience, even enough reporting time to sort of get that kind of perspective? And how much of a challenge was that for you?
As opposed to
writing this book. The contrast is obviously like Doris Kearns Goodwin writing the book about the Roosevelts 30 years later.
You know, I think that covering any White House is such an enormous team sport, right? Across mm-hmm. publications and across time. And it really, it's sort of like the more well-reported books, the better. This book answers a really specific question. I knew that it was going to be published in the run-up to the mm-hmm. 2012 election. And an important question for me, and I thought for voters, would really be, how have these people changed since getting to the White House? What really went on there? What was it like for them to confront this world and these new roles? And how is the couple that we're looking at now different than the couple we met in the 2008 campaign? So I really reported the book to answer that question. But, you know, I look forward to, you know, the version of this book or a slightly different book that'll be written in 2 years and 4 years and 8 years and the Obama's memoirs, eventually. And I think it sort of takes the whole, you know, collection of different kinds of journalism done at different points to capture it.
Because there's a real premium now in doing these sort of quick, I'm not saying quickie at all, quick right. books, right? Because it's a very well-reported book and very insightful. How different do you think this book would be if you had waited 10, I mean, I know you couldn't have, but waited 10 years and done it? Like, what do you think you'd be able to have done differently than you did here?
Well, you know what I think is interesting is our colleague Peter Baker is working on a book about the Bush administration. And, mm-hmm. you know, I know it's going to be a great book because he's just a fabulous journalist. And I think what's so interesting about somebody at the paper asked me recently, why do you think he's doing a Bush book now of all times? And I said, I haven't asked Peter this, but I totally understand the draw, which is that once they're out of office and right. the staff has dispersed a little bit and things have cooled down a little bit, I think you would actually find that sources have more perspective, right? I mean, not only would you have a different perspective as a journalist, but people would be, you know, you see a lot of people in this book being very much caught in the heat of the moment. Like the most surprising moment of my reporting really came when Robert Gibbs spoke out against Valerie Jarrett. I mean, I was very surprised, but he's the former press secretary and still a member of the Obama fold. And he said to me, you know, Valerie is manipulative. I don't think she's an honest broker. I think she promotes herself at others' expense, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, that is such a rare...
It's remarkable. For anyone to say that, but for Gibbs, that jumps out in the book, because people just don't do that.
People just don't do that. Yeah. And so
it shows how angry he must have been at Valerie Jarrett. Right?
I know. Yeah. And so I do think it's an interesting question. In 5 or 10 years, how is he going to regard that relationship and that experience?
Right. And I guess the question is, do people become more candid, more thoughtful about what they went through? Do more documents become available?
Or do they become less in a way, right? Because, you know, I was very surprised talking to people at the White House. I would say to them, are you writing things down? Are you remembering things?
Right.
Like, I was essentially saying to them, I know there are things you're not going to tell me now. But just as a journalist and somebody who cares about history and information, it was important to me to know that they were kind of remembering and archiving this stuff. And you would be surprised. I mean, people would either say, I'm too exhausted, or I don't want to take notes because notes can get subpoenaed, or some situations had turned so negative that you almost felt like people wanted to burn the proverbial letters in the fireplace and have them be lost to history.
Right, because there was a lot of, I remember this was during the Clinton administration, they began, I guess it was Josh Steiner, they began subpoenaing diaries.
Yeah.
And because of that, people in the White House are told not to keep diaries anymore, which is really a shame.
Exactly. And he was a relatively junior guy, too.
He was a really junior guy, yeah.
And he got caught up in this whole crazy thing.
Yeah.
And then, the other thing we see is that presidential and first lady memoirs are very political in their own right. I mean, we hope that this president will write a pretty forthcoming one, but the truth is they're legacy polishing documents.
Right.
And it's very hard, I think, for a former president to be tough on his own staff.
Right.
Because these people have served loyally and given so much that for a president to criticize a Gibbs or an Axelrod or a Jared or whatever, it doesn't happen that often.
Right. As opposed to the staff being critical of the other staff when they come out.
Exactly.
Talk to us. I know you've been asked about this a lot. You guys probably read some of this, but why was it that the Obamas, do you think, agreed not to do interviews for this book ever after having talked to you during the campaign?
I was given a couple of different explanations. One was that I did have this very big interview with them in 2009, mm-hmm. and
it's from one of our long run series, right? One of the sort of
it was for the magazine.
It was for the magazine
piece I wrote about their marriage. And the White House did say to me, you got that big interview, and that was kind of enough. And, mm-hmm. I think what outsiders may not understand is that it's really, these interviews are extraordinarily difficult to get. Like, I think our White House correspondence team, am I right, has only sat down with the president once?
Twice, maybe. During the campaign, we sat down with him literally once.
Yeah.
And after that, they wouldn't do it again.
And we're the New York Times. Right. So if they, if we can't get it, it's not like there's another publication out there getting 10 of these sit-downs. And so so I think that was one reason. Another reason was that they said the First Lady just doesn't do book interviews, that she's essentially saving everything for her own memoir. And then a third factor, because we were really talking about it until right up in the end, we were still having conversations about a potential interview in mm-hmm. October, and they had a final discussion in the White House, and it was right after Ron Suskind's book mm-hmm. had come out.
The president did talk to Ron Suskind.
But they really hated that book, yeah. and they said... they said something like, we learned our lesson. And and I know there are other book authors who have not gotten interviews since.
Has Woodward gotten a book off? Got an interview? Do you have a sense of that? Bob Woodward? He normally does.
I know he's doing a new book, but I don't know that much about what he's gotten so far.
Let me ask one more question, then we'll take it out to you guys for more. If you had been given an hour with them, give me a couple of examples of questions that you might have asked them. What would you like to know? Or what would have helped?
I think would have been the difficult decision for me is that, the way it works is that you're only given an interview or not given one at the end of the book reporting process. And so at that point, I had all this sensitive information, mm-hmm. right, about stuff that had happened behind the scenes, and I would have had to make the decision of how directly to confront them mm-hmm. about it. Because on the one hand, you don't want to ask innocuous questions, but on the other hand, to look at Michelle Obama and say, did you know that Robert Gibbs, used the F word about you in a meeting? That's a very uncomfortable question.
It's a great
question.
I'd love to know the
to
answer.
To question, yeah, yeah.
I'm guessing the answer is yes.
Really?
Valerie never told?
The Obamas did not find out that had happened until they were told, before the book came out, they were told that I had that. So I think the decision I would have had to make as a journalist was kind of how much to tell them I knew and get them to try to respond to. Mm-hmm. Because you want to try to do a little bit of that, but on the other hand, you want to get them to speak more broadly, to the themes of the book too, and I would mm-hmm. have wanted to try to get them to reflect on some of the changes had experienced in the White House.
Self-reflect about how they've sort of changed. Some of the questions they're asking you.
Exactly. Yeah. And so if you get too confrontational with the, I know that this bad thing happened, you can kind of shut off some of the more reflective stuff. So I would have had to try to find that balance.
Okay. Let's take a couple questions here. There's microphones in the audience. Let me, while I'm here, ask you, it's a beautiful building and a beautiful library, so you guys should all support the Friends of the Library and join.
And before we do questions, I want to thank both the library and also Adam, because it's really a privilege to have him here with me tonight. Adam has taught me a lot about political reporting, so it is fabulous to come to your turf in L.A. and do this.
Thank you. But you can't leave yet. Okay, so I think... give your, I don't know if there's rules here, but I would say give your name and end every question with a question mark.
My name is Marcia Caden. I live on the west side. It's hard to drive this far down, but I had heard you on the radio, and I really liked how you presented everything you said about the book in such an even manner.
Thank you.
And I've only read about 65% of the book, but I was wondering, Michelle Obama is stated to have many secretaries and many more dressers than any other first lady. How does Washington feel about that?
I'm not sure that that's right. I've heard that repeated before, but I don't think it's true. The number of, staff in the First Lady's office stays pretty consistent from era to era. She has one kind of wardrobe assistant that she's hired to help her. And then, of course, like many women in public life, she hires people to do, you know, her hair and makeup, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm not sure that she's got a larger retinue than prior first ladies. Sure.
My name's Alan. And at the very beginning, you mentioned that both Obamas wanted to be these transformative, wanted him to be a transformative president. And as a progressive, and I think many people agree with me, that's my biggest gripe about him, that he hasn't been transformative at all. And he hasn't tried to do big things. He ran this on this whole idea of change. So what is the disconnect there? And do they actually believe they have been transformative to this point?
That's such a great question. You know, I was thinking about this just again this week with the super PAC money, right? And with Obama, you know, agreeing to kind of form tighter alliances with this outside group, because there is this pattern in his career that we've observed again and again where he comes in with a desire to do things differently and to really change the culture of politics. And during the campaign, he certainly succeeded in doing that in certain ways. And in the White House, it has been so much harder. And I think a lot of the work of the next couple of months, in a way, is really figuring out and tallying the administration's accomplishments. Because if you take something like his record on the environment and energy, you know, there have been, on the one hand, he's made some progress, certainly. And then on the other hand, there have been so many compromises and so many areas where liberals and progressives, right, have been frustrated and disappointed that I feel like part of our job is to convey a sort of realistic picture, you know, of how much he's really moved the ball forward. And then I think there's the fascinating question of a second term. I mean, one of the things that I'm watching for as a reporter covering this race is what Obama's vision is really going to be for what he wants out of a second term, and how realistic is it going to be? Like, when he did his first fundraising speech last spring for re-election in Chicago, he was saying things like, we're going to pass an energy bill in the second term. And, you know, I just looked at it and said, well, you know, if the House still belongs to Republicans, and if some of those members don't even believe in climate change, how is that possibly going to be? And he seemed sort of, you know, once again, like a guy who was promising things that he wouldn't be able to deliver. So, you know, even with State of the Union last 2 weeks ago, you know, he laid out a pretty compelling vision, right, for a nation that is more economically just. And it's very hard to argue with that. The question is more, can he really accomplish what it would take to make American society economically fairer?
Jody, quick follow-up, because you hear this sort of complaint from progressives enough a lot. I wonder, how much of it do you think is a communications problem? In other words, like, I'm putting myself as an historian in 10 years, and with all due respect, I'm thinking, okay, this guy got through a pretty big healthcare plan.
Right.
He got us out of the war in Iraq. He dealt with the financial, I sound like David Axelrod here. He dealt with this financial crisis, and he did it in the most impossible political environment I've ever seen. He got engaged in the military. And I'm just wondering, I actually kind of think that if we're having this conversation 20 years from now, people are going to say, this guy really got a lot done and was a pretty progressive president. Am I wrong about that?
But isn't it interesting the kind of repeated anger and scorn that the White House has shown progressives? And it does seem to come from the president himself. There are a lot of some, there's been some of it in public, but there are also...
Well, Gibbs, right? Didn't he do that a couple times at the
podium? Gibbs did
but
that.
But I think they get angry at questions like that. They shouldn't, but they do. They get sort of their bat dander
up. But it's interesting. Like, there are also a lot of these stories from fundraisers, mm-hmm. for example, when the president is confronted by very wealthy mm-hmm. liberal fundraisers. You know, he has often had kind of thin-skinned,
right.
defensive
right.
Responses. They're trying to smooth things over now, but there are
right.
stories of progressives being kind of yelled at,
right.
you know, by the in almost the same tone, right, that they yell at reporters sometimes,
right.
like a kind of "don't you appreciate how much we've done" tone. And I think it's interesting that the president goes to that place and not a more kind of, you know, "let's take a step back. I completely understand what you're saying. I've
right.
been thinking about that a lot" kind of tone.
Wasn't one of the things Michelle Obama very upset about that you wrote about was that she thought that they were not doing a good job of communicating what it was that the president had accomplished?
Absolutely. That she was concerned from early on that the president was not telling a clear story
mm-hmm.
to the American people. And, you know, it was interesting that she identified that so early on, because that pretty quickly became the conventional wisdom,
right,
I
right.
think, in Washington as well, that, you know, especially economically, it's really only in the last couple of months that we've seen this administration have a clear economic message.
Right, right.
I mean, I remember in the campaign we were talking about this. We didn't really think he had a clear economic message in 2008.
No, definitely not. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to yabber.
Hi, my name is Jim. Do both of the Obamas want to have a second term, and why do you think they do?
I think they absolutely do. They're fighting really hard for it. And I think it's, you know, what Gibbs said when I talked to him about this is that it's very much about validating the first 4 years for them. If the president loses in 2012, the great Obama experiment will be considered to some extent a failure. You know, all of those noble ambitions and excitement and all of that innovation and the campaign and all of those hopes, you know, ending in ultimately in defeat. And so they have both thrown themselves into reelection wholeheartedly. For the First Lady, you know, I often think that campaigning and fundraising is the only way she can kind of get back at Republicans for, you know, the way they've blocked and stymied her husband. You know, this is what she can do, and she's going to do it.
Plus, she has that huge staff at her disposal, right?
Right.
My name is David Moody, and my question is about a trial balloon that went up a few weeks ago. The White House as jail, okay? I understand that there was some move to remove the president's office from the White House and put it somewhere else. Is that a possibility, assuming that, of course, nothing would happen until the election? But would that be something that the Obamas would treasure?
I never heard anything like that, to physically remove the Oval Office.
They want to do, I think I actually know the answer. There's a renovation that's due to the White House. I've read this. I didn't report it myself. There's a major renovation, structural renovations being done of the Oval Office. So they're going to need to move the Oval Office to someplace else while they're doing it. But they're not going to permanently move it. And I bet they don't do it before Election Day just for political reasons.
Harold Kalishman. You haven't mentioned the extreme hostility that they experienced even before the election, even before they took office. How much of the disdain that they have and the bunker mentality that they may show glimmers of do you think is due to both, I mean, Tea Party, Republican diehards, Fox News, et cetera,
I think it's a great question, because they've definitely faced not only some very negative things, but some scary things. During the really raucous town hall meetings over healthcare in the summer of 2009, there were people who brought signs to those meetings saying things like "death to Michelle and her two kids." You know, really shocking stuff that I think would be very, very hard for anybody to deal with. And then you have coupled with that the Obama's newness, you know, in a way, and their quick rise. The president in his political career did not really face a series of tough opponents. He lost to Bobby Rush in 2000, but his Senate victory was a cakewalk. John McCain ultimately wasn't that strong a candidate. Hillary Clinton was probably the toughest opponent he ever faced. And so I think you're right in saying that, you know, almost anybody in that position would want to go to ground, you know, a little bit. Sometimes there are behaviors on the part of Obama that I do think are just reactions to sort of the state of politics. Like, you look at the way Mitt Romney has a pretty similar response to campaigning than, you know, that Obama does, which is that, you know, you can tell that Romney doesn't really enjoy it. And so on the one hand, you could say, well, it would be great if he was a better retail politician who really savored, you know, the kind of human contact and excitement of a campaign. On the other hand, you look at a modern presidential campaign and you say to yourself, it's sort of a bit much to ask anybody to truly enjoy this, right?
Except for reporters, we love it.
Thank you, Jody Kantor, for writing this book. Who's taking care of the dog now? Do they ever take it on the road? And have you ever met the dog?
Oh, I've met the dog a million times because the dog is the most accessible member of the Obama family by far. And he really is the perfect, you know, White House pet because, as we just referenced, the Obamas are so protective and careful and meted out. And, you know, even when they do parties, they often stand behind a rope line or whatever. The dog doesn't care who touches him, you know. I was standing in, like, an East Room waiting wing a couple of months ago, and Bo was in there, and everybody else was petting Bo. And they said, Jody, pet Bo. And I was like, I don't know, I'm a reporter. Like, am I really going to, like, get down and dirty with the dog? Is that weird? You know, what if somebody takes a picture of me playing with Bo and puts it on the internet? Would I be embarrassed? And the cool thing about Bo is that it ultimately doesn't really matter because he's a dog.
Did you meet the daughters at all?
I've run into the daughters a couple of times in the White House, and I have to tell you, it's a little awkward because. Yeah. I mean, they're very natural, but a couple of months ago, I was standing in the diplomatic room, and the thing that's significant about the diplomatic room is that it's on the first floor, it's sort of facing the lawn in the back of the White House, and the Obamas do not have a private entrance and exit to their house. In the book, I actually put maps and floor plans of what the White House looks like because I wanted to show what an unusual way this is to live. And so it was like 3:00 in the afternoon, and Sasha and Mrs. Robinson, the First Lady's mother, were coming in. It was pretty clear Sasha was coming from school. She had a backpack. And the White House staff that I was with just kind of nodded very briefly and smiled. But I felt like I wanted to melt into the wall because it really came home to me that this is where these people live.
They have such an unprivate life.
Right? I have a mom and I have a 6-year-old. Yeah. And I felt a little bit uncomfortable that she had to pass a reporter going into her own house.
What do you think, and you write about this in the book, what do you think about the way the Obamas have sort of treated the privacy of their daughters versus maybe using them as campaign sort of, you know?
Well,
I'm trying to ask that in a neutral way, seriously.
I think they've done both. Okay. Because I think Malia and Sasha, the people, mm-hmm. are very, very tightly protected. But Malia and Sasha are also characters in right. their dad's political rhetoric. And I think it's remarkable how much he references them and right. kind of turns to them. And I think we'll see a lot more of that as the campaign gets underway. And, you know, the thing is, it's been that way since the beginning of the president's political career because, it was always this situation of, you know, here was this guy with this unusual name, and he was African-American, mm-hmm. and he had this exotic background. And, like, white voters in downstate Illinois could look at these two little adorable girls, and they were like the connective tissue. You know, people could identify with the Obama family. So I don't know if he would be president if he didn't have these two cute, really cute, appealing kids.
They're adorable, right?
They have, from the beginning, they're what's humanized this candidate.
And they're sort of more front and center than Chelsea Clinton ever was, as I recall, right? Chelsea was really...
That's an interesting, it's interesting. I mean, I remember being down in Orlando,
right.
like the day before Election Day in 2008, and we were doing a ground game story,
right.
And I was looking at the very kind of fancy, polished literature. You know, they were doing door hangers, like these kind of leaflets that you hang on people's mm-hmm. doors, and the big glossy picture on the door hanger was of Sasha. You know,
really?
And we're talking about Florida, Orlando. This was one of the most contested places in the entire country, and so I thought that was so interesting. That if they're doing that, it's based on a lot of polling, right? It's based on real data.
My memory is right; they did have a big role. I think they did have a role. They were there on the stage at the end of the convention, right? Absolutely charming.
Oh,
right?
I remember the story. I remember the story you wrote about that.
Someone does. Sorry. Okay.
Hi, my name is Matt Peake. I live just a couple of blocks away from here. And I have a question about an editorial that your colleague Tom Friedman wrote maybe 6 months ago.
Oh, my God. Don't make us answer for Tom.
I'm not going to make you answer for Tom, but I want to ask your thoughts, and especially in specific context. So he wrote, the gist of it was that it's no longer the first 100 days, it's the only 100 days. Saying, and you know, if you look at Obama's presidency, at least from my point of view, it seems to be true. Big things came about in the first 100 days, in the first year, and since then has been a lot of politicking. So I wanted to ask you if you agree with that, but more specifically, another really thought-provoking article came out by Andrew Sullivan a couple weeks ago that praised Obama, and in a nutshell, it basically said that he had adapted to somebody that could do subtle behind-the-scenes tactics for steering the presidency. And I'm wondering if, in your opinion, this characteristic of Obama just further reinforces this only 100 days notion. I'm wondering your thoughts in general on how much this only 100 days notion plays into the staff dynamics and the relationship dynamics of the president and the first lady.
Well, I guess the contrast I would draw is that in the first 100 days, Obama really had the wind at his back because not only was he a new president and he was very popular, but he had the support in Congress that he needed to get things done. And if you look at the situation now, even if he wins a second term, you know, he is very limited, obviously, in a budget sense, and the House is probably going to belong to Republicans. We're hearing some fantasizing now about the Democrats taking it back, but it's too early to know. And so I guess going into the 2012 election and a potential second term, one of my big questions about Obama is how creative his use of presidential power is going to be and what he's learned about the use of presidential power. Because if he's going to have a successful second term, I think he's going to have to be very inventive in the way he both gets things done in Washington and also the way he reaches out and uses public persuasion to try to inspire the country.
Is I find a little bit of a disconnect in that when you talk about him as president, how he doesn't like to do the socializing and the schmoozing, and even at the Super Bowl party just wants to sit down and watch the game. And I find that remarkable for a man who came up so quickly in Chicago politics, which I don't know Chicago politics, but I'm from Philly, and it's sort of the same thing. You've got to know people. And I remember reading a New Yorker article about how he worked Chicago politics and so on. So how did that happen in Chicago when then he gets to Washington and he doesn't want to do the schmoozing and all of that? That obviously must have helped him in Chicago.
He did a certain amount of it in Chicago, and some of it is a function of him having been at a different stage in his political career. I mean, I was recently talking to somebody in Chicago who was saying, God, I remember that, you know, before Obama made it big, he used to go to these events and he used to shake every last hand in the room, but that was really because he had to. You know, he had no choice in a way. And also Chicago is a more comfortable environment for him, right? I mean, he loves it there. He talks about it constantly. That's where his roots are. His antipathy towards Washington is barely disguised. I mean, he, you know, it's sort of in the beginning of the administration, he tried to be more diplomatic about it. That's gone now. I mean, there was that great Mark Landler story a couple of weeks ago saying how the president's strategy for 2012 is basically to run against, you know, the Republican Congress. And so, you know, I think it creates a difficult social dynamic in certain ways too, right? Because if you're the president and you're kind of running against Washington and running against the Republican Congress, it's not clear whether you can really have a great day-to-day relationship with these people.
Is part of that also the line in your book about no new friends? So you can't, as opposed to when you're in Chicago as a senator or whatever, you can't really trust anyone anymore who wants to be your friend in Washington because they want to do whatever. I mean, do you think that's part of what the dynamic was here, that he closed himself off because he didn't know why so-and-so might be inviting him and his wife to dinner? Or...
Yeah, and I think it's also part of Obama's belief that politics is really fake.
And dirty, right, yeah.
It's fake, you know, yeah. And it's part, like remember during the oil spill, the country really wanted him to give a, right. You know, a speech that channeled the real anxiety and disappointment that people felt. And people in the White House, you know, I remember talking to Valerie Jarrett about this, and she would say, well, the president is not an actor who is going to profess fake emotion. And it was like, wait a second, nobody's asking him to say anything fake. People mm-hmm. want him to say something real.
Okay. Well, I think, unless there's any more questions, which are... Okay. Okay. Go buy books, sign books.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.